Hi, I'm sports journalist Tim Livingston.
And I'm Bobby Glanton Smith. This is Westward.
Westward is a production of the Dan Patrick Podcast Network and iHeartRadio. Episode 6, Fine by Me.
The Clippers were unbelievable last night.
Are the Clippers the best team in L.A.?
The Clippers are the best team in L.A. because they're the tougher team in L.A.
The Clippers are just mentally and physically tougher than the Lakers. Whatever their DNA is, they're sheer scrap.
With the Clippers' second victory in as many games over the venerable Lakers on Christmas Day, for the first time perhaps in their tempest-swept history, the city of Los Angeles was now their home, too.
We're burying the lead here. Kawhi Leonard, once again, for the second time this year, outshined both LeBron James and Anthony Davis on both ends of the floor.
They've been able to take it to the Lakers, and they've been the more impressive team so far this season.
But in a sad irony, the moves that Jerry West and the Clippers front office had made that previous July, moves that changed both the course and culture of the team, were made on the anniversary of what was the franchise's biggest move. The one that had taken them from their original home.
Buffalo's got a spirit, talking proud,
listen up and hear it, talking proud.
On July 7th, 1978, the Buffalo Braves left Buffalo.
I was 11 years old when they left. I was pissed off my entire life.
Sports journalist Bucky Gleason spent his entire 30-year career covering the city where he was born. Buffalo. In a city that has experienced its share of sporting disappointments.
Lowry hit it. He missed it to the right.
No event cut deeper for Gleason than the loss of the Braves.
I was born in 1967. The Braves came in 1970, so all of my were about the Braves. My birthday is June 28th. And they left on July 7th, which was just a week and a half later after my birthday. And I remember thinking, I'm 11 years old and I'm crying because my team left. There's nothing like that feeling when, you know, as a young, impressionable 11-year-old kid, just having his team ripped away from him. For me, it was anger that I held for probably the next 35 years until I was able to finally sit down with the owner, Paul Snyder, and find out what happened.
What happened to the Braves in Buffalo has been said by many of their fans to be the reason the Clippers franchise is cursed to this day.
You know, the funny thing is about Paul Snyder is that, you know, I didn't even get into this before. I didn't even mention it. I'm mentioning it now. I wanted to fight the guy. And I told him when we sat down for our interview that I was like, do you know how long I wanted to punch you? You know, the Braves, they were actually a pretty good team. They were competitive on the floor. They were competitive at the gate. Now, if anybody was to go back and look at their attendance figures, and they'll see, you know, 8, 9, 10,000 people at a game. It was competitive with the other teams in the NBA. And you have to remember, the NBA was at a war with the ABA. They were trying to figure out how to make it all work. It wasn't the NBA, you know, the giant that you see today. They had Adrian Dantley. He's a former Rookie of the Year. They had Ernie DiGregorio, who was a great guard, coming out of Providence, point guard. They had Randy Smith, who was a local product, went to Buffalo State College. Moses Malone was on their roster. Ty Archibald came through the system. So this was a team that was really in good shape in terms of being competitive. They had a lot that you could build upon. The problem that Paul Snyder had was securing dates.
When I made the deal for the Braves, I had to deal with the Sabres, and the Sabres locked me out of having a weekend playing date. The Sabres played Sunday. Canisius College had a long-term contract on Saturday nights. The Braves had to play Tuesday and Friday in direct competition with all the high schools, and it's very difficult.
It's really tough. when your dates are Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays, say, where you can have open dates to play basketball. They were not making the money that they needed to make. And so Paul Snyder thought it was a good idea that if he could partner up with John Wybrown as the ABA started to dissolve, this would be an opportunity for him to gain more leverage. And then it all just went south very quickly.
Before he was governor of Kentucky, John Y. Brown was a successful entrepreneur in Lexington who made his fortune purchasing the Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise and turning it into a fast food Goliath.
You make this shot, you can have anything you want for dinner.
I have Kentucky Fried Chicken, Mom.
Still in his early 40s, Brown spent his considerable treasure pursuing ownership of his favorite sport.
You know, I grew up in basketball country from Madoff up to the present day Calipari. It's our life here. It's basketball country. So I've always been interested in basketball. And I guess I got searching around the league and I was trying to see if we could put some kind of merger together when I was president of the ABA. And I talked to most of the owners and I ran across Paul at the time. And then I read that he was in trouble moving the team out of town. I called him. I said, Paul, you know, I like basketball. I'll do a deal with you that can work for both of us.
John Y. Brown ended up taking over a majority interest. He was always looking for the next move and then realized he was going to pull them right out of Buffalo. And it was the beginning of the end of the Buffalo Braves.
It just didn't work out. And it didn't seem like there was any future. So then I bought Paul out. And then I looked around to where to take the team.
What happened next was not unprecedented in the insular world of professional sports ownership. Just years earlier, the NFL's Carol Rosenblum, owner of the Baltimore Colts, had orchestrated a similar deal with owners Robert Irsay and Bud Keelan of the Los Angeles Rams. But it had never been done before in the NBA, and never would again.
Now, the Celtics were owned by Irv Levin at the time, and so John Y. Brown, he had a conversation with Irv Levin, who was trying to get out of Boston. John Y. Brown was trying to get out of Buffalo. So they essentially swapped franchises.
Someone suggested to get together with Irv Levin, and I didn't know who had given me the idea. But I talked to David Stern maybe 5-6 years ago. I just happened to call him. I always had a good relationship with him. And he told me he was the one that suggested to get those two guys together.
So that transaction went through, and Irv Levin, who was from Southern California, if I'm not mistaken, was able to move that team from Boston, essentially, to San Diego. And so it was really a complex transaction. It ended up being part of the Braves being moved to Boston, part of the Celtics being moved to San Diego along with the other part of the Braves team, if any of that makes sense.
Well, I got a lot of heat, but I didn't want to stay around, which I don't regret because the circumstances didn't justify continuing on here.
You know, this is one of the great what-if stories. What if they would have waited? What if they could have hung on for Larry and Magic to come in? What if they would have had the foresight to understand what it took to build a good team leading into that period? I mean, it's just such a Buffalo thing to have happen. Like, the confluence of things that could have gone right that just didn't go right. It's not just the Bills and Scott Norwood and Wide Wright and 4 Super Bowls. It's not just, you know, 2 Stanley Cup finals. It's also the Braves. And for them to take that with them to San Diego and the Clippers being terrible for all those years, well, for an 11-year-old kid, fine by me.
You are listening to Westward on the Dan Patrick Podcast Network. We'll be right back. Irving H. Levin was born and raised in a hardscrabble working-class section of Chicago, but had moved to Los Angeles as an adult, where he became a successful film producer before purchasing the Celtics. His eldest son, Lon, remembers his father's story well because he was part of it.
My father was a basketball nut. And in college, he went to the University of Illinois. He played on the freshman basketball team, but knew that he wasn't good enough to continue. So he became the announcer for University of Illinois. He got involved with the Seattle Supersonics first through his business partner, Sam Shulman. Once they were part of the Sonics, they got the opportunity through David Stern because they knew who David Stern was. I remember him telling me that he and Harold Lipton were in a meeting. They were in New York City. Someone came in, told Harold that the Celtics were for sale. And so my father, immediately they jumped on the opportunity. Because he was still an owner of the Sonics, he could not officially own another team. So he had a friend named Bob Schmertz. They made an agreement and they signed it on a napkin. I was in college and he called me up and he said, I just want to tell you that we now own the Celtics. I said, wow.
Although Irv Levin's Celtics would win a championship in their first year of ownership, the Los Angeles-based businessman would never feel embraced by the old town's hardcore fan base.
He was born in Chicago, but we've been in California since 48. West Coast guy, and he was in the entertainment business. Boston's a very tough place. And they saw him as a carpetbagger, you know, who just came in and really, Red Auerbach was the man there. They didn't want to have an owner like my dad. Even today, the feeling that people in areas like Boston or New York might have about LA people is that we're lazy and we're just hanging out and having a good time and smoking grass and whatever. That's as opposed to they're hardworking. But I think that there was a bias against my dad, who actually was a Midwesterner. He was not, you know, because he grew up in Chicago and he was a street guy in Chicago and came up through the ranks. So he just felt that there was no appreciation, and it came to a head in the season after the championship. Now, I was an art student at Art Center College of Design. I was doing my advanced, I had already graduated UCLA. I had designed a poster, a John Havlicek poster, which I look at now and I realize it's really pretty horrible. But my dad made them distribute it when they did their tribute to John Havlicek, who was retiring. So when that day when they did the presentation to John Havlicek, you know, where they went on the court, my dad came out and gave him different gifts and things. My dad was roundly booed by everybody.
John, on behalf of the entire Boston Celtics organization, both past and present, we are pleased to present you with a 31-foot sports coach camper. And may you enjoy it for a long, long time. Good luck. You've got a lot of class.
And I remember I was in the hallway leading out to the players' locker rooms. When he came by, he looked at me and he said, I'm never coming to this fucking place again.
For most of Lon Levin's life, his father had wanted him to follow in his footsteps. But Lon Levin preferred the arts, a choice that created a disconnect between the two.
My dad and I did not have a good relationship my whole life. The one area where we really connected was sports, in particular basketball. That was the area that he and I found common ground. And so when he called me to ask, and he said, we're bringing the team, the Braves, to San Diego, and I want to know if you want to be involved. I thought it was a great opportunity for me to finally get to know my father as an adult and for him to get to know me as an adult.
And on July 8th, 1978, the San Diego Clippers were born.
San Diego, city in motion, a forward-looking city, alive with dreams and plans for the future. yet a city with a sense of the past.
We had that first year that was pretty great, and it really established the Clippers as a viable entity.
Lon Leven and his father's Clippers would finish their first season with a respectable 43-39 record and boasted the league's number four offense. But in a coda to the franchise swap that would bring the Clippers one step closer to Los Angeles, one that is surely to sting their long-suffering fans. In the part of the deal where he would choose which players to go with him to San Diego and become Clippers, Leven passed on the Celtics' 1978 top draft pick, an unknown forward from French Lick, Indiana, who was playing out his final year in nearby Terre Haute at Indiana State University.
Red Auerbach knew about him. My dad had no clue. Didn't know who this guy was, how good he was or anything. Just knew that they had this guy. My dad didn't know too much about it. And so he said, well, we'll take Freeman Williams. I don't know if you remember Freeman Williams, but he was the top scorer in the country at the time. And so they thought, oh, this will be great. We got this guy, and we don't know if this other guy can even play. So they opted for taking Freeman Williams and some players.
Irv Leven and the rest of the league would soon know about that other player when he joined the Celtics the following year. The almost Clipper would go on to lead the Boston Celtics to three world championships and become one of the greatest players in league history. His name was Larry Bird. You are listening to Westward on the Dan Patrick Podcast Network. We'll be right back. The Clippers' relocation to Southern California was due in large part to the Los Angeles Lakers. Writer Terry Pluto, author of several books on the NBA's formative years, explains that the city of Los Angeles figured prominently in the landscape of the league at that time.
The interesting thing to me about the Lakers moving was it began like kind of a gold rush. If you think about Los Angeles in the 1960s, you're not that far away from World War II. My father was stationed out in Santa Barbara and L.A. during the war. And, I mean, he really did talk about it like the promised land, the land of milk and honey. You know, you didn't have all the pollution and a sense of overcrowding, and it was a sense of endless possibility. And I really believe that was also appealing to Short, too. And the players, they were so excited. I remember when I interviewed, like, Hot Rod Hundley and Elgin Baylor and some of these others. They were telling me when they came out there, you know, they hopped in their cars and went. Short even told his players, I mean, it sounds like the wagon trains, sell everything you got, just keep what you can and put it in your car, and maybe get a little trailer behind your car. Just go on out there and buy new stuff in California. That's really what Short would told the players.
The success of the Lakers was responsible for the NBA's West Coast expansion and the creation of the ABA, which put its flag in the ground with over a dozen teams. And in the long run, it was good for the game, but there was a period from the merger to 1979 where it looked like the game just wasn't going to survive.
When you look at the NBA in the late 70s, they were in huge trouble, partly because of what was done with the ABA. But this was like a long guerrilla war that lasted 9 years. Neither side ever expected that. The ABA figured the NBA would capitulate and take in some of the teams. The NBA figured the ABA would run out of money and go away. And in the meantime, you know, the ABA did things like began taking underclassmen with Spencer Haywood, you know, the quote-unquote hardship rule. They were just stealing players. They even stole officials from the NBA. They did a lot of things. It was all-out warfare. The ABA gave out a lot of these contracts where they were paid out over 20 years and a lot of the money wasn't guaranteed. And agents were taking those ABA contracts, going over the NBA, and then getting guaranteed contracts out of that. And so it was hurting the NBA economically because they didn't understand what was going on. And it nearly bankrupted everything.
The 70s was a dark period for the NBA because while the merger brought the best of both leagues together, it also brought the worst. The NBA was still an old boy network. It was your dad's league. Not a whole lot of pizzazz, right? The ABA was the opposite. So you had this weird hybrid of players and teams and styles that just didn't mesh. And the result was a league of long hair, short shorts, and a lot of fist fights.
Getting a little physical. Get out of my way.
I should say.
That play was not in the playbook.
Yes, not. Look at Akeem go at it. This wrestles him down, and both benches empty. And a melee is broken out here. They have brought police onto the floor.
The NBA's on-court violence had become a huge problem for the league. Game 2 of the 1977 Finals was marred by an ugly brawl involving the 76ers' Daryl Dawkins and the Blazers' Maurice Lucas.
Dawkins just breaks, goes down to the ground, and jumps back up. And Ramsey's out on Dawkins, and Richie Powers is pushing Ramsey away. And now, Daryl Dawkins and Maurice Lucas. Somebody do something. It's Dawkins and Lucas. Dawkins and Lucas.
Early the next season would see Kareem Abdul-Jabbar break his right hand while punching Bucks center Kent Benson. And just months later, a fight erupted between the Rockets and the Lakers that would send Rockets all-star Rudy Tomjanovich to intensive care.
The NBA's brand at the time was at an all-time low. Fights, drugs, sagging attendance. And it got so bad that by the end of the decade, CBS was showing the NBA Finals on tape delay.
Public interest in the NBA hadn't just dulled. It had all but disappeared. And the Los Angeles Lakers were no exception. By the 1978-79 campaign, attendance at the Lakers' Fabulous Forum in Inglewood had dipped by nearly 200,000 fans since their championship season in 1972. Gone were the halcyon days of Baylor and Goodrich and Wilt. And though they had attained one of the league's best players in Lew Alcindor, who had changed his name to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the team would only reach middling success, made palpable by a familiar face at the end of the bench who shed his number 44 jersey for a suit and tie as the team's coach.
Jerry West was a very underrated coach. He made the playoffs every year he was on the bench. He won almost 150 games, but what was really bigger than his role as coach is that Jerry kept the Lakers relevant in Los Angeles, which was key, because just as the Lakers and really the city of Los Angeles had saved the NBA when they relocated from Minneapolis in 61, they were about to save it again, only this time on a much bigger scale.
My introduction was usually on a Saturday. I worked for my parents at the time. It was Superior Stamp and Coin. And this gentleman would come in and buy coins, and he would spend, you know, $200-$300 on a Saturday, which was good money back then. This is in the late 60s. And he would fill up his Whitman blue folder books. And after about a year or so, this was going on, he was a teacher at USC. He was a professor, which I thought was good. But those Saturday afternoons were, I looked forward for him coming in and filling out those boards, and he told me his name was Dr. Jerry Buss.
Even at a young age, Gerald Hatton Buss understood the value of something rare. As a 10-year-old boy living in Los Angeles, he could often be found in his room sifting through jars of coins, hoping to fill out his penny board, or studying the latest issue of Spink & Son's Numismatic Circular. Though the boy would only spend a few years of his childhood in the City of Angels before moving to the rugged rural plains of Wyoming, a love for both the City of Los Angeles and coin collecting would become passions. But it was his love of the latter that would bring him a lifelong friend in Ira Goldberg.
He had a softness about him. He came from a broken home. He fought his way up and was very street smart. Believe me, he was street smart. So you get an idea of his personality. Sitting at a game together, and he always sat in lousy seats. He said he never wanted to sit down on the floor because he said that's, you know, for people who want to be seen. So we sit in the worst seats, but it was always fun having being with him. And he says, Ira, what are the three most important American coins? So I'm eating a hot dog, and I just that develops. There's an 1894 S dime, there's a 1913 nickel, and an 1804 silver dollar. And they're the three classic American great rarities. He said, well, what do you think it would cost to buy these? And I said, Jerry, I don't know. They're not available, but it's got to be around $1 million. He says, go get them for me. I said, well, just like that. So all I was doing was eating a hot dog, and I had it wrapped in a napkin. So I jotted down, Ira, go get me the three following coins, the 94 is dime, the 13 nickel, and the 04 dollar, approximately $1 million. And he signed it. I saved the napkin. 30 days, I chased down all three coins and I sold it to him.
Returning home after the purchases, the real estate mogul, film producer, and entrepreneur stepped into his den, pulled out the original penny board he had used as a boy back in Wyoming, and stared at it for a long time. His board was now full. It was early 1979. He was only 45 years old and worth $60 million. Jerry Buss, the businessman, was fulfilled. But Jerry Buss, the gambler, wanted more. For his entire adult life, the doctor had rubbed elbows with some of Tinseltown's brightest stars. Though he had dabbled in filmmaking, he didn't want to merely produce something as part of the Hollywood machine. He wanted to create a main attraction. As a chemist, Dr. Jerry Buss knew about combustion. He understood its elements. And he knew that if he could somehow combine glamour, the love of basketball, and his flair for entertainment, he would not only create something that would be a main attraction, he would create something that would explode. Dr. Jerry Buss then made the decision to buy an NBA team.
He wants something he wants to go after. And he wanted an NBA team, so it just so happens that the Indiana Pacers becomes available. And he decides he's going to go ahead and he buys the Indiana Pacers.
Next week on Westward.
Long before Jerry Buss came up with the idea of Showtime, there was a coin toss. And while it would only be fitting that the greatest beneficiary of the coin toss would be a coin collector himself, the actual winner had already lost.
Dad had the club for so many years, and it had become extremely successful. But in the 70s, he had some personal problems. And at that point, he had said, you know, I have to sell. Jerry Buss wanted the Lakers badly.
Laker owner Jack Kent Cook's asking price was nearly $68 million. And Jerry Buss didn't have it.
He says, well, I think my friend Donald Sterling will buy the majority.
The deal between Jerry Buss and Jack Kent Cook would move forward, but Buss seemed to have inherited a team whose good fortune may have run out.
Jerry Tarkanian is a successful coach at UNLV. He's an ethically sketchy coach, but he's very successful. And Jerry Buss decides, this is a guy I'm going to hire to coach the Lakers. And he interviews him for the job, and Tarkanian is very interested in the job, and he's going to take the job. And then his agent winds up dead in the trunk of a car.
Paul Westhead would now have to deliver for the Los Angeles Lakers.
I was their only choice. I mean, they had a game that night, and if I didn't show up, well, the trainer would have been in charge. Had we lost that opening game, I probably would have coached my last game.
Westward is a production of the Dan Patrick Podcast Network, iHeartRadio, and Joy Road Entertainment in association with Workhouse Media and Sugar 23. Executive produced by Paul Anderson and Nick Pinella for Workhouse Media, and by Michael Sugar and Mike Mayer for Sugar 23. Joy Road Entertainment is P.G. Cuccieri, Jim Young, Matthew Hatchett, Tim Livingston, and I'm Bobby Glanton Smith. Produced by Casey Whalen, edited by Charlie Magdaleno at Whalen Productions.
Producers would like to thank Bucky Gleason, John Y. Brown, Lon Levin, and Terry Pluto for their contributions. And of course, the great Jerry West.
Westward is narrated by Emmy Award winner Keith David. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.